This is Back to Back.
Yo, what's up, Back to Backers? This is Willie Joy. Welcome to the show. This is Back to Back. This is my podcast. You're listening to it. I'm talking. That's how it works. Every single week, this is how we do it. How are you? How you feeling? It's good to be back with you. I've got Carl Craig on the show. Let's get that out of the way at the top. The legend himself, one of the cornerstones in the foundation of techno music. I caught up with him at his studio out in Detroit. He's got a lot going on right now. Check this out. He just did a sound installation, an art exhibition at Dia Beacon Gallery. That's out in upstate New York. It's called Party After Party, and it just reopened. It was something that they designed and set up before the lockdown happened, and it was just allowed to reopen. So if you're anywhere near the upstate New York area, they're doing appointments, social distancing, you know, all of that. But the installation sounds amazing. We talk a lot about that in the conversation you're about to hear. Carl Craig also put out a song called Lotus with Dubfire and Kate Ellsworth earlier this year. And in 2019, he released the second volume of his Detroit Love DJ Mix series. You got to go check that out too. So I'm going to put a link in the description of this episode where you can go keep up with Carl Craig, go follow everything he's doing, get all the new music, check out the art installation. All of that is in the link in the description of this episode. Also in that description, you're going to find another link. That link is to come join the Back to Back Discord. That's my server. That's my chat. That's where I hang out every single day, talking to people, talking to the awesome community around this show. We talk about this week's episode. We talk about, you know, the issues that come up. If you're an aspiring musician, if you're a producer, there's a place where you can share your music, get feedback, and connect with other musicians. So hit that link. Come join the Discord. I want to see you in there. Say hi to me. I love connecting with every single person who's out there listening to this right now. That's you. If you're hearing my voice, I'm talking to you. If Discord isn't your thing, I would love to connect with you on social media at Willie Joy or at Back to Back Pod on all social media. That's also the best way to support this show, is to let people know you're listening, to help us spread the word. And whether it's tagging us in your stories, putting up a tweet, letting people know they should be listening, maybe tagging your favorite artist, let them know they should come on the show, or even just telling a friend who loves music as much as you do, they got to check out what I'm doing over here at Back to Back. All of that is how we grow. It's how I'm able to keep doing this show, keep making it better every single week for you guys. And it's a great way to connect with me too, because I see everything everyone's putting up. I try to interact with really everything I see that tags us, and I've made some pretty awesome relationships based out of people I've just met from doing this show, man. I gotta tell you, those connections, you know, that's the part of projects like this that people don't talk about as much, but they're the ones that end up being the most meaningful, and you can never have enough of them. So hit me up, let people know they should be checking out the show, and much love to all of you out there who have already been doing that week after week. I see you. So look, it's been a weird week. I've been a little off the grid, at least a little more than usual. The last like month and a half, 2 months, I've just been recording a crazy amount of podcasts, like multiple episodes a week, really, really filling out the vault here. And this week was the first week in a long time where I didn't have anything scheduled. And I kind of just leaned into that, really stayed away from anything podcast related. To be honest with you, it felt great. It felt like a little reset that I needed, gave me some more time to work on a couple mystery projects that I have alluded to on this show before. Some new music is definitely in the works, but you're not going to hear it for a little while yet. But man, I'm psyched for when you do. I'm working on some fun stuff. I hope you're doing that as well. You know, whatever you do, whatever your life is about, I hope you had some fun this week. Hope you were able to, you know, find some joy and some moments somewhere in there. And I hope this can be one of them too, man, because I loved talking to Carl Craig. On the day we were recording this, I was also recording a different interview before I talked to him. And it's funny how this works. I was nervous to talk to Carl Craig. He's a legend. We did not know each other. And there was just so much to cover, you know, in a 30 plus year career, talking to someone who pioneered a genre that is now a global phenomenon. You know, it's hard to know where to start. It's a little intimidating. And then the person I was talking to earlier that day, you know, I felt great about it. I was like, this will be great. I know this person. I'll talk to him. It'll be easy. It'll be fun. And then, of course, on the day of recording, it was the total flip. Talking to Carl Craig was amazing. He was an awesome conversation, easy to talk to, extremely interesting. And then the other person I talked to, you know, it was just a little tough. They're not all easy. They're not all seamless. We made it work. It ended up being a great episode. I'm not going to tell you which one it is. You'll hear it, you know, within the next month or two. But yeah, that one was kind of like pulling teeth. And Carl Craig, man, could not have been more enjoyable. Fascinating guy. You know, his Planet E record label, which is, you know, over 30 years old now. It was super influential to me when I was coming up as a DJ and to anyone who listens to or enjoys techno music. I mean, we all owe Carl Craig a pretty big debt of gratitude for helping turn it into what it is today. We bounced around a lot, hit a bunch of good points, a ton of great stories. There is so much more I could have talked to him about. Hopefully we can come back sometime, do a second part. You know, maybe in person once things get back to normal. It's crazy, man. I can barely remember doing the podcast in person anymore. And that's how we did it for the first like 3.5 years of this show. But I'm not complaining. You know, the plus of doing this through Zoom, doing it remotely, is that I'm able to talk to people maybe I couldn't have talked to before. People like Carl Craig. So in that sense, man, this episode is just a present. It was a present for me, and now it's a present I can give to all of you. So let's do it right now. This is me and Carl Craig back to back. Let's go. Is this your studio in Detroit? Is this like a complex you live in? Do you have a separate studio?
Yeah, I built a room in the backyard. So onto the back of the house. I had the guy who originally designed Electric Ladyland Studios.
Oh wow!
His firm did the design and architecture. So they did the whole space. So it's almost like another building that's right on the back of the house. So
that's convenient, not, man.
We call it an extension, but it's, you know, if it would be like the size of maybe a small party store or something, you know, a candy shop, if it was in a building by itself.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think it's good to have a separate space mentally, you know, just something that doesn't feel like you're working out of your house, just to separate, you know, that work-life balance.
Yeah, it's good. It's good for me because, you know, I had a building, kind of a not, you know, not like a big Detroit building, but it was, you know, a spacious building on its own, and definitely not in walking distance from either where I was living when I had gotten it or where we live now, but in the sense of you know, a bigger city like New York, it would probably take about 40 minutes to get there, but in Detroit time, it takes about 15.
Right.
So relatively close in comparison to you know, other cities and stuff. And that one was like, it was like running a boat, you know, because you could be in one side of the building and it's raining and you don't even know that it's coming through the other side of the building. And we had that on many occasions where it would just, you know, it would just pour through. We had damaged records. We had all kinds of things. And you know, the Detroit dream, I think, is always to, you know, own a big building because they're cheap in Detroit.
Right.
They're still cheap, even though the cost of them went up. They're still very cheap, and you know, you could get into owning a building that has 5 floors, 10 floors, and you can't even use a quarter of it, you know, but, but you know, you have this big ass building. So it's like, you know, buying a Rolls Royce,
you know, and it's then like having to maintain it, right?
Exactly. And then having to maintain it, you know, so you're rolling around town in this big ass Rolls Royce, and it's not really necessary. You could roll around in a Escort or you know, something that's smaller.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that we're talking about spaces and creative spaces, because I was actually just reading that your art installation just reopened out in New York. And I was reading up about, you know, the space that's in. For the people who don't know, you know, it's in a converted warehouse space. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I was just thinking about like repurposing spaces and how we reuse spaces and how that's tied into your music and techno music in general. I think techno is a lot about recontextualizing sounds and spaces. And maybe just to start off, for anybody who doesn't know, what is the party after party installation exhibit that you did?
The project, which is at Dia Beacon, which is considered upstate New York in some way, but I think it's called Hudson Valley is what it's in. So they have this big former box factory, and I think they used to make boxes or packaging for Nabisco or something like that. So, you know, it's a really a gigantic space. With multiple rooms. My favorite room is the Warhol room. It's got a beautiful a series, you know, one series of Warhol that goes all the way around the whole room.
And oh, wow.
The room is probably 5,000 square feet or, you know, maybe even more, you know. So my piece is not directly below it, but below it. In what's considered a basement. And they usually have like Dan Flavin pieces down there, the light installations from Dan Flavin. And in another part of the basement, there is a big Flavin wall that's down there that glows neon. And my room is it might be 20,000 square feet maybe. Hmm. And a lot of columns. And a lot of windows. And when I first saw it, of course, there were all these ideas that were coming to mind. But, you know, it definitely is like going to, you know, a rave back in the 90s, reappropriating an abandoned warehouse. So it's got that vibe. But it took a while to come up with an idea of how to use it, because the room has so much, it's so big, it has such a long decay time. So, you know, any transient, any bass, anything, it just travels what seems like it's forever. And that made it difficult. But the idea came about, or the result is a piece that encapsulates my experiences, you know, as a traveling DJ, as a DJ period, and the good times and potentially the bad times.
Right.
So the party, which is the first 25 minutes, is a piece that's like, you know, just a grower. It builds into this, you know, like pulsating dance track. And it includes, so it starts off with like a hit, a chord stab, and a voice. and then it builds into a bass line, and it builds into effects, and then the drums, and then it goes in and out. And at one point I have something that's called Detroit Chords, which is like this kind of Nice of the Jagger kind of chord progression.
Yeah.
That leads into it. And all the time the room is dark, except for lighting on the corners. Mm. And there's no club lighting. It's not meant to be like a club lit thing. So the party is meant to put you into the frame of mind of what it would feel like if you're at a party in a warehouse.
Right.
The after party is what's more personal to me, because the after party name is deceiving, because everybody thinks of an after party and they're like, okay, yeah, we're gonna get down, it might not be as hard, but we can, you know, we can party for the next 10 hours in somebody's loft, and
yeah,
you know,
keep
whatever
it going, yeah,
and keep it going, keep the party going, you know. But in this situation, it's my experience after I finish playing, when I go back to the hotel and there's, you know, nothing but a room, and usually when you're traveling international, only CNN on TV or something. So, you know, you're sitting there in the room with your own thoughts, of course, the come down of what happened at the party, but then the come up is the tinnitus and the ringing, and you know, the tones, the high pitched tones that you can get from, you know, banging in a club for, you know, 2, 5, 10 hours, whatever it might end up being.
Yeah.
And you know, so the after party is really the stark truth, or my truth, of really the life of a DJ, a traveling DJ. And so many people want it to always be like, oh, you're the DJ, it's always a party, you know?
Yeah.
And oh, your life must be so simple because all you do is play other people's records and you get free drinks and girls are throwing themselves at you and blah, 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 blah. But the reality is that no, you know, this is really the life of what happens. It's not all private jets and limousines. It's,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of pain that's involved. And it's not only the pain of paying your dues to even get to that point, it's the pain of, you know, what you have while you're doing it. So it's like when you see a basketball player sitting in a tub of ice.
Right.
You know, I mean, it takes a lot of, they put a lot of pressure on their bodies. There's a lot of brutality that goes on there by football players. I mean, God's sakes, yeah. You know? So all you see on TV is these guys scoring touchdowns and gloating and, you know, or making baskets or, you know, whatever the case is, gloating. And then you see, you know, excerpts of them at the club, you know, with strippers or whatever the case is. And it looks all great to live that kind of lifestyle. But, you know, there is the pain that's involved. And, you know, when the party's over, you know, when the party's really over, and we're living with that pain, and that pain of tinnitus and you know, headaches and all kinds of things that can come from, you know, being in a loud musical environment.
Do you get tinnitus pretty bad?
I've had tinnitus for a long time. I've been listening to loud music since I was a kid. I have a older brother. And while my mom, and she would say this all the time, I was trying to get you to listen to Alvin and the Chipmunks, and your brother was playing Black Sabbath. So, you know, I've been listening to, you know, my brother's music since, you know, he really got to that age, and he's 9 years older than I am. So,
oh, okay.
You know, I mean,
so he could really put you up on what was happening.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. So, you know, when he was 18, I was 9. You know, so, and he was listening to loud music before that. So I could guess I've been listening to loud music since I'm 6 or 7 years old.
Yeah, no, me too, man. And it's, I have a little bit of tinnitus and it pops up at random times, and it's, I'm thankful it's not worse. It probably should be worse for all the abuse I've put on it. Mm-hmm. Do you wear earplugs to the club ever?
You know, they're ear condoms, and you know, yeah. Sometimes you like to just go raw dog.
Yeah. Yeah. I hear you.
Of course I'm going to pay the price for it. But I do have fitted earpieces, and you know, it takes a lot of sensitivity away from what I pay attention to when I DJ.
Yeah.
So I try to wear some type of protection when it's not my own music, because why should I lose my hearing for somebody else's music?
Right.
You know, but I'll go full hog for my own music, you know, because I want to. You know, I want to feel it. I, of course, I need to present, you know, the music in the way that I feel most comfortable, so that people hopefully will enjoy it as much as I do. But yeah, I live for my music and I'll die for my music. And obviously I'll go deaf for it too.
I respect that, man. And I think even what you were just talking about with the after party idea and sort of having that come down moment, that weird moment when you're just alone in the hotel, it's kind of the same thing, right? Like we give a lot the same way with your athlete metaphor. You give a lot for that, the event or the moment, you know, it's that altered experience. You're connecting to something crazier that is almost like an out of body experience for me. Yeah. And then afterwards, yeah, that's kind of, I don't know, in a weird way, I don't like putting it out there because I don't want to tell kids to just like ruin their hearing and do crazy stuff. But at the same time, some of those moments, you know, I wouldn't trade it for anything.
Yeah, right. You know, and you know, you're right. When you're playing, you know, what was it called? 4 for 4 or something like that. It was a ESPN thing where they did the Bad Boys. They did Detroit.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah, that was great.
Yeah. And they showed how Isaiah had basically broke his ankle, but he finished playing the game.
Yeah,
you know, on a broken ankle. Just, I mean, the adrenaline that comes from being Isaiah in that situation, and that desire to just, you know, to be the best and to be the winner is something that, yeah, you know, maybe down the line he's like, oh, I really shouldn't have done that. That was really stupid. But damn, that was a great game. Right. Damn, that was a great game.
Sometimes there's no other choice, man. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and thinking back to what we were just talking about, the art installation, the warehouse and the different spaces, you know, if you look back at when you were just coming up in Detroit and just starting to be exposed to electronic music, what kind of spaces were you going to as a kid? How were you seeing music presented to you when you were young?
You know, I watched a lot of television. I watched a lot of television. So everything that I got outside of radio came from TV. Mm. And, you know, I remember going nuts over seeing the B-52s do Rock Lobster on Saturday Night Live. You know, that was like, oh my God, that was incredible to me. And that kind of pushed my buttons for what I wanted to do. Cause I think at that time, yeah, I wasn't playing guitar. I don't know if I was playing any instrument, but there was something about that I just really was intrigued by. It was amazing. Because before that, you know, I was listening to Parliament Funkadelic on the radio, my brother again, a lot of rock stuff, a lot of Prince, you know, that was happening. Actually, Prince, I think Soft and Wet might have came out the same year as Rock Lobster. 79 might have been an amazing year.
Yeah, that's a crazy year.
yeah. So you know, I was getting all this stuff on the radio, but then to actually see it in front of me in that intimate you know, space that would you know, that wood stage of SNL that's iconic for Saturday Night Live for, you know, at least the first 20 years or something. It seemed like that wood stage, and you see somebody perform on there, and it was it was just amazing. And then later, because we had something called Ethnic Festival is what it was called down here. It was at Hart Plaza, the same place where we do movement. And every weekend there was a different ethnicity that had a festival. So one year it would be Greek. One weekend is Greek.
Yeah.
The next weekend is Polish. The next weekend is whatever. And I would go with my family down to see that. So I would get music from that. But the real up close and personal thing that touched me was my cousin was doing lights at the time, and he took me with him. I was about 14 or 15. He took me with him to an icebreaker at Michigan State University, up in Lansing. And I saw these guys direct drive DJ. And that's the first time I ever saw anybody scratch before, like actually in my face and stuff. Right. I mean, I'd seen it on TV and everything. But, you know, and the hot record at the time was Ice-T Reckless. That was from the Breakin' movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they're just scratching up a storm, and I'm watching the girls, and, you know, it was amazing. So that was like, you know, that was the thing that burst my cherry. But then the next thing that really overwhelmed it, that took me to that next level, was seeing Jeff Mills play. He was playing at a theater, and I had never seen anything like this. I mean, when Jeff was the wizard, he was like a freaking killing machine. This guy was, you know, his hands one hand might have been a chainsaw, and the other hand, you know, the other hand, AR-15 or something. Right. He was just chopping and shooting and chopping and shooting and chopping and shooting. And it was incredible. And he used to do this thing where he had a guy standing behind him. So when he was done with a record, he'd throw it in the air, and then the guy would catch the record.
Oh, man, and that's amazing.
Yeah. And it was like, and, you know, Jeff was known for playing a record, you know, a record a minute, you know, at the time, maybe at that time it might have been a record a minute, but he had to, you know, he had to let the record work, especially for the black audience. It wasn't a situation like where later when he was playing techno, a lot of the grooves of techno is exactly the fucking same. So, you know, he could just go and put on another song, and it's just, you know, and, you know, he's doing his thing. But in this time, you know, if he played Juni Morrison into Play at Your Own Risk into, you know, something else, he had to have enough of that in there where you were going to really groove to it. So a minute, I think, was about the minimum that he could play a track and not get on people's nerves.
Right.
But it was amazing. It was like watching, like seriously, like watching David Copperfield or something, you know, something that you just realize that the magic that's happening is just,
I know what you mean. And I think there's something in what you just said about, there's something about like using technology in a new way or in like the quote unquote wrong way that I think is really exciting. And I think a lot of origin stories, you know, the origin of techno or the origin of lots of genres, it starts that way, right? With taking something that already exists, a turntable, and using it in a way that nobody's ever expected, or taking a drum machine and distorting a note and stretching it out, you know, that kind of thing. And for you, when you saw Jeff Mills or when you heard something like that, was it an instant, I want to do this kind of moment?
I don't think it didn't touch me that I wanted to be a DJ then. It didn't touch me. Like my idea of being a DJ was more like a radio DJ.
Sure.
And really, up until the time that I left high school, I almost went to broadcast school, you know, because that was going to be, that was my idea. And of course, in Detroit, when you grow up around people who, or a culture that's surrounded by unions, it's a unionized city, or was more of a unionized city, you know, there's this pressure of to legitimize something, you know, or do something that's already set up that's legitimate.
That's interesting.
You know, what Jeff Mills was doing was incredible, but it wasn't necessarily a legitimate situation.
Right.
You know, it was like he was the wizard, and you could see why if he was walking around with a briefcase of $1 million in it, it's like, okay, that's because he's a fucking wizard, you know. It's not because he's a DJ and somebody was going to pay him $1 million to play a couple of records. It was because he's a wizard and he deserves it.
Yeah, know? Of course. I mean, I had Kevin Saunderson on this show, and he was talking to me about some of his early years, and really talking, what I took from a lot of it was, you know, he was talking about at the start of all this, you know, it was techno and all these innovations. I mean, it was a local phenomenon at first, right? Wow. And it just kind of felt like, at least what he was saying was, you know, you kind of knew everybody who was into it. There were just a couple places you would go to hear it. And it wasn't this established thing. It was kind of just everyone was experimenting because it was exciting. And because, mm-hmm. you know, it was just what was happening in the town at the time, yeah. without so much of a thought of what could come out of it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Was there a time for you, was it... I have to imagine maybe this didn't happen till much later, but when you sort of realized that outside eyes were looking at this more and that maybe there was something really to this that could take off?
The outside eyes came with the Future Sound of Techno, Detroit, the Future Sound of Techno compilation. And when Face magazine came to Detroit, so Face was like ID magazine, or, you know, so it was a mix of fashion and music. And that really was when it seemed to me completely legitimate. Unfortunately, it was legitimized from outside of the United States, you know, in comparison to it being taken seriously inside of the United States, which was much later. When I saw that Depeche Mode came to Detroit to chase down Derek May, and there's photos of them in the Face magazine in his loft,
right?
You know, looking at cookies or, you know, whatever they were doing, it was like, okay, yeah, this is the shit, you know.
And where were you at with it at the time? Were you actively involved? Were you making music or DJing at that point?
Yeah, of course I was making music. DJing was something that came a little later. I mean, I was toying with it, but my first, what I would say my first professional gig was in Belgium after I had already started my own label. So I was making music with Derek from about 88, and it was right around the time, I think right around the time when that Depeche Mode thing happened, when they came and that happened. So I didn't meet them. So that makes me think that they came before I was hanging out with Derek.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah. And was it crazy to see how it was connecting with people like across the world? What were those early experiences traveling for techno music?
Well, I mean, I saw how that music connected with people in Detroit through the Music Institute, and how they could play Big Fun, Inner City Big Fun, three times in a row, and everybody would go crazy every single time that it was going to be played, or that it was played. And I think it was Juan, and Kevin and Derek and Daryl Wynn, D-Wynn, that were doing Fridays. And it was just an energy that was incredible. So, of course, I expected the same thing when I left Detroit for the first time to go to the UK with Derek. Mm. And, you know, it was nothing short of amazing. It was pretty much the same excitement in England when we went to London as it was in Detroit. You know, just bigger crowd. So
yeah, because they had a crazy rave scene in the late 80s, early 90s, right?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. And when I got there, it was right when it was really, really taking off. So I was there when Tony Humphries played the first night of Ministry of Sound.
Oh, wow.
I was there. I saw Tony Humphries play as Shum. But what was the big deal, and I didn't go to this, we were supposed to go to this rave, and I didn't know what it was, and it was out in the country, and I don't remember why we didn't go, but it became big news the next day. You know, the promoters flying in a helicopter, you know, it's out in a big field and you know, they probably had 10,000 people out there and all this stuff. And this was like the beginnings of rave becoming demonized in London. Mm. You know, for having too many people, for there being illicit drugs, for there being you know, just all this money that's being generated that's probably not being paid in taxes.
Yeah.
And, you know, just all this stuff that was making rave look bad. But I didn't go to any of the warehouse parties. But those were happening at the same time, you know, as the raves were going. So they were doing a lot of raving, but I was going to Heaven. So I saw Red Zone.
Now I'm forgetting it.
Yeah.
Too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know who you're talking about.
Why isn't his name coming in my head? But anyway, I saw him playing at Heaven, and that was the first time I heard Pump Up the Jam. And that was a big deal. You know, I was there when Pump Up the Jam popped.
That's
was there
crazy, yeah.
When Ride on Time popped and Lolita Holloway was crying her eyes out because they ripped her off. And, you know, I was there at maybe the best time for London electronic music to really, really jump off, you know, as far as just, you know, everybody was, I remember going to record stores and the vans would pop up and, you know, people were waiting for the vans to come and just all these, they would, you know, they probably had 100, 200 pieces of vinyl every week, different new pieces of vinyl. It was just an explosion of music. London is something else. It's not like any place else.
It's in their blood, I think. Yeah.
It must be.
Yeah, I mean, culturally, I think I've been talking to a few people in the UK lately, and there's, I think, something about like the BBC institution, BBC Radio 1, like people just grow up. It's like in the fabric of their lives, dance music, you know? Did it influence you? Like, did it influence the music you were making at the time to have those experiences out there?
Oh, yeah, of course it did. Of course it did. I mean, I was really intrigued and excited about what was coming out of Europe anyway, because we were listening to the Electrifying Mojo, who was a radio jock here, who was very influential, not only on us, but almost every type of music that came out of Detroit from the 80s, from the 70s and the 80s has had his finger, you know, fingerprint on it. And he was playing, Gary Numan and he was playing Lana Lovitch and playing like all this other shit, Visage, you know, not Fade to Gray, but Frequency 7, a track that nobody was playing. Mm. He was playing Frequency 7. And for us, he was Peel.
John Peel.
John Peel. He was like John Peel on the BBC for us in Detroit.
Right.
So we were hearing this, you know, European music, and he was really hammering Kraftwerk, the Computer World album, Pocket Calculator, Numbers, all that stuff. We were just, it's more fun to compute. We were just all like going nuts over this. So, you know, many people, it's hard for them to believe that there were hoods and players and stick up men and, you know, that were listening to Kraftwerk. They couldn't fathom it, that there was this stuff that was coming out of Europe and it was appealing to Black people in the United States. Because you go to some place like Honest John's in London and, you know, they're like totally into Bobby Womack and all the stuff that was like pig feet eating music to me. That was like too, it was like really more like rootsy older people music.
Yeah. I love that you said pig feet eating music.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause that's exactly what it was to me. It was more like this kind of Southern style that the majority of people who listen to that stuff had seemed like they had roots to the South that were stronger than my roots to the South. My mom grew up in Georgia, but she never listened to any of that kind of stuff. She listened to B.B. King, and that was her blues point. And then outside of that, she wasn't really listening to that stuff. So it was my generation of people, we were listening to what Mojo was playing. So Mojo is the reason why Derek Mays said techno is like George Clinton and Kraftwerk stuck in an elevator, you know, because that's how Mojo was playing. He would play Mothership Connection and then he would play, you know, Numbers.
Right.
You know, and then he would play, of course, Bambaataa and, you know, all that stuff as well. But he was playing Peter Frampton. And it was this movement of music that was quite broad.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting to hear you talk about those early days and European sort of not being able to comprehend or not connecting with this idea that, you know, they're were Black people in the hood who were liked this music and listened to this music. I feel like, and you tell me what you think of this, but I feel like in 2020, we almost have the reverse issue where, you know, dance music and techno, and it's worldwide, obviously, fans all over the world. But in sort of in the same way, I think people, the roots of it have been not lost, but I think a lot of people just haven't done the homework or really understood where it came from. And again, would be almost surprised in reverse. Yeah. To find out, you know, the origins of this music that means something totally different to them.
Sure. I mean, I've talked about this before with how we even got to this point musically. It started with, man, my memory is just Robert Johnson, right? So it started with Robert Johnson. And what was called race music here in the United States, which is Black music.
Yeah.
Mostly blues, Southern blues. It was raped, borrowed, stole, and whitewashed in the U.S. by people like Elvis.
Yeah.
You know, Pat Boone was covering Little Richard's stuff. Little Richard put on a record and Pat Boone would cover it. And, you know, and people would think it was Pat Boone's record, right. not the richer. And that's the situation that we're in now, is that, you know, people think that techno is this music that's not black, but, you know, it's Juan Atkins, who's a brother from Detroit, you know?
Yeah.
So we have a similar history to that, and what has been integral in the development of people really paying attention to rock and roll in the United States and blues and stuff was because of the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, Eric Clapton. You know, all the guys before weren't given their due to these pioneers of blues and you know, Chuck Berry, all those guys that were the starting point for all this music. It took the Beatles to come over and say that they like Motown, you know. It took it took Mick Jagger and Keith Richards to talk about Muddy Waters, you know. It took Clapton to talk about B.B. King, you know, before this stuff ended up being able to get into the mainstream, which, you know, like selling a million singles is one thing, because selling a million singles it was amazing that Motown could do it. You still had to get paid for those million singles.
Yeah.
But, you know, it wasn't going to be very often that you would see a black artist that was on American Bandstand, you know, or any of those kind of music programs, music dance programs, until, you know, they were getting dap from the outside.
Right.
So like with techno, you know, the English have been really good at being the people, the leaders in music education on a personal basis, right? Because in the UK, they'll talk of these guys, they all know who we are, and they pay respect to the guys from house, from Detroit techno, from rap, from all that stuff. But in the US, you know, it just becomes like, okay, well, I think the music becomes more throwaway because we're living in a throwaway society.
Yeah.
You know, new Jordans come out, you take the old ones and you put them in a box and never wear them again. And you just keep running through shit like that.
Yeah.
You know? So
yeah,
the music
is disposable.
Is very disposable.
And I mean, another thing you just made me think of is that in those early days, you know, certainly you weren't being put on by anybody. You know, this is something that you and the people we've been talking about, you know, Juan Atkins, Derek May, Kevin Saunderson, all that, you know, you built it yourself. And maybe that's a good way to talk a little bit about Planet E, your label, excuse me, that you started, you know, very quickly after you started making music, right? And putting out records, like just a few years in, you started that, right?
Yeah. Planet E, I started as a reason to do music myself under my own rules. And I didn't realize that musicians really don't start labels, you know, and that wasn't an issue for me because I didn't know. I came in it totally ignorant because, you know, the gods were doing it before me, Derek, Kevin, Juan. So I was like, yeah, I could do it myself too. But before that, I don't really think that you found musicians that were really able to sell their records. You know, you had an accountant that was a music lover that decided to start a label, a gangster that decided to start a label, you know, whatever it might end up being. And we were able to do it in a very DIY way. And you know, I always looked at how I supported the label as me being, mercenary and guerrilla warfare and all that, because I would do remixes for the majors and I just put it right in my own label to keep making my own music, you know? And that was, you know, how I thought it should be. You know, you should invest in yourself if you can. And that's what it was. So I think if I was working at the post office, I would still be, that would be my guerrilla warfare. I'd be out there, you know, throwing mail in the boxes and then getting home and banging, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah. I love that, man. That's by any means necessary, right?
By any means necessary.
Yeah. And now it's, you know, what, almost 30 years later and the record label's still going.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And
how has it changed, you know, running it over 30 years? I know it's taken on different forms and sometimes the label's been super active and sometimes it's pulled back a little bit. Yeah. You know, where are you at with it now? How has the business changed in almost 30 years for you?
Well, so many distributors have gone out of business even before, 2001, like 9/11 and things that happened after that point had a big impact on the music industry. And when, you know, the music 9/11 was Napster.
And, I've never heard that. That's good.
yeah. So that was crazy. I remember reading, I think that was in 2000, New Year's going in 2003, about, you know, how the music industry was really changing and deteriorating and everything that had to be done in order to fight. And the records that were selling at that time was like Eminem. I mean, that was the big deal. And, you know, now we can still produce records, but, you know, the idea of a hit is different these days than it was. So like before us as artists got together and made these records in Detroit, you know, a hit was, I don't know, it could have been 30,000 or something that you had to sell, you know? And then as time went on, it seemed like the threshold of the hit went down.
Yeah.
You know, 10,000. Oh, it's a hit. 10,000. You're able to sell 10,000 independently. That's great. It's a hit. Then it got down and got down and got down. And now, you know, people are happy to press up 200 copies.
Right.
And that blows my mind. It's crazy to me that 200 copies of vinyl is considered, you know, outstanding in sales. It just doesn't make any sense to me. And I still don't quite understand the machine of streaming and how to really make a shit ton of money out of streaming, you know? And I say shit ton of money because, you know, you have to be able to support your art.
Right.
And if Bette Midler back in the day was saying that she got $1,000 royalty statement for a million streams, you know, that's just like, I mean, that's just crazy. It's crazy. Yeah, it's, you know, crazy. It's freaking crazy, you know, cause a million of anything back in the day should, you know, meant that, you know, you were able to do your art. Everybody got paid.
Right.
But now, you know, it seems like you got to do 100 million streams, you know.
Yeah, and I
billion
think,
streams, yeah. All these things, the level, that is not, doing a billion streams is not indie label logic.
Right.
That is not an indie label logic. That is not an artist, that's an artist's dream that you say, yeah, we do a billion streams, but, you know, how much money does it take in order to actually generate a billion streams, you know, that you actually get paid for.
Yeah. And I worry too I don't think the streaming paradigm's all bad. Like, I never want to be that guy who's just saying, oh, I was better in the old days. But to me, one of the major issues I have with it is what you just said, added to the fact that I think people are chasing they're changing the kind of music they're making in order to appeal to the new paradigm. You know what I mean? Because certain types of songs, even certain lengths of songs, do better on streaming.
Right.
And that, to me, when you're changing your art to appeal to what is at the end of the day an algorithm, like you're just trying to make music that an algorithm likes, that to me is such a crazy idea.
Yeah.
I don't even know. I'm just ranting now. I don't know where I was going.
No, that's cool. That's cool. Because, you know, we can go one step further from the algorithm of creating something to satisfy the algorithm, which the algorithm in turn can generate what would be considered its own music based on what satisfies the algorithm. So a lot of the AI music that's been talked about for the last few years, you know, as the AI stuff happens, you know, it's very possible that it could, you know, it could put so many people out of business, because all you have to do is do the AI and then do like something like Gorillaz,
right?
You know, where it's like an animated thing, which could probably be generated by AI as well. And then it just cuts out, you know, all human aspect to it, because us as adults that's been listening to music for a long time, we know we know when there's emotion that is put into music. We can feel that because we have the experience of that, you know. But my young kids, if they're listening to AI, it's just something that appeals to the child's ear, you know, like music candy, which so much music has been generated to be candy, you know? So what their threshold is going to be is a lot different than what we're going to be in. Yeah, there could be a movement later that is like, oh, I could hear how that sounds real and how this doesn't sound real, but people like fucking auto-tune. And it's like, come on, if you like auto-tune, then it makes it very difficult to distinguish what is supposed to be a real singer. Yes, you hear Beyonce sing and it's like, goddamn, that's something else. But there's 100 other tracks or 100 other people that have come out with tracks that are all using auto-tune in a very synthetic way. And that's become the typical sound of pop music, you know? I mean, before Kanye was doing it, it was T-Pain.
Right.
And it was like every record was T-Pain, but every trap record or rap record or whatever you would hear for 2 years, it seemed like they would do that auto-tune, where it just goes...
I know what you're talking about.
Steps up and down, you know?
It's like 40 MIDI notes, yeah.
Yeah. It's insanity. It's really insanity. I love technology, but I just can't imagine what is going to really be the case in 30 years. I mean, if there's a movement, and I wish that there was a movement to go back to really playing and really singing and everything, that if we could get rid of the procedure of how people use Pro Tools and Logic and all that, and just get it where you put a couple of mics up, you press record, and then the band plays.
Yeah.
And then you do some overdubs and it's done, you know, and, you know, a really clean old way of doing it. A friend of mine, Benny Rodriguez in Amsterdam, he gave up the computer and started doing things the way we were doing it back in 1989. You know, you had a sequencer, you had you have a 909, you have a 101, you have whatever. And then you restrict yourself to those three or four pieces that he has. And I think he's even recording a DAT now. So, you know, he's like actually taking it back, which I like. I really like.
you know, talking about sort of taking it back, looking back at the old ways, and, you know, how technology is just a little odd, our relationship with technology in 2020, yeah. which I think is interesting for somebody like you to say. I think people might be surprised to hear that, because when I think about what you've done, when I think about techno music, you know, it's futurism, it's experimentation. And it makes me wonder, you know, for you writing music, getting excited about music now, how do we maintain a healthy relationship with technology? How do we evolve ourselves as technology evolves and still push boundaries without sort of falling into a lot of the pitfalls that you were just talking about?
Yeah, I mean, there's always going to be those pitfalls. You know, we get so wrapped up in anything that we can get wrapped up in, whether it's materialism or whatever. I mean, there are people who actually fuck cars or something. You know what I'm saying?
It's great, like, example. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just, there's always gonna be that, you know, you buy a new computer and, you know, the whole world can open up for you, but the beauty of the computer itself is something that can, you know, make your mouth water, make you get so excited that you have like the status symbol, like a Mac or, you know, whatever it might end up being, the newest design, 16 inch, yeah, flat, you know. So it's kind of hard not to fall into pitfalls. Social media is one big, huge pothole.
It's, oh man, yeah.
A sinkhole, you know? And social media is shaping our culture, you know, on a world level as humans. Humanism is changing. Humanity in ways that... that seem to be positive, but then you just get this whole group that will flip it into this negative thing.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like the concept of fighting for right, for what would be considered equal rights, like Black Lives Matter. And then how the term All Lives Matter can be weaponized so strongly, because you know exactly who the fuck you're talking to when they, yeah, say All Lives Matter.
100%.
You know, if I'm talking to an Italian guy, like I had a conversation with somebody when I was in Italy recently, and I understand Italians, and he goes, well, excuse me, but I really believe that all lives matter. And it's like, okay, I understand where you're coming from because we are in Venice. But I had to tell him that in the US, it's usually the biggest assholes.
Yeah.
It's usually somebody that is just like, well, fuck Black Lives Matter, All Lives Matter, when they don't believe it themselves. You know,
right.
If they believe that all lives matter, then they wouldn't be biased against Asians. They wouldn't be, you know, biased against Hispanics. They wouldn't have issue with Aboriginal people. They wouldn't have, but it's usually what would be seen as white nationalism. An all lives, yeah, matter thing is a white nationalist thing to say. And it's crazy that it's like that.
Oh, you know? Man. I mean, yeah, you're, this is all I've been thinking about the last, I mean, God, months and months, man, because it's been such a crazy climate in the country. And yeah, even musically, you know, now you're talking about social media and how that can be dangerous. And, you know, I'm seeing a lot of artists be scared to be vocal about what's going on in this country or about their political opinions, just because of the level of vitriol is so crazy. And, you know, there's just so much, like you just say one thing, yeah, that, like Black Lives Matter, that should not be anything that anyone disagrees with, right?
No.
And you just say that and you get all these crazy fucking weirdos coming out of the woodwork. I don't know, man.
And I don't believe that these people don't understand that Black Lives Matter 2 is the meaning of it. The English language, it has a lot of peaks and dips and stuff like that. But it's not like German, where German's very specific, right? English, you have to use your imagination, you know? You have to read into it, but read into it the correct way. But American English or American logic has become something where you read into it as being a negative, or you have to get defensive about it. And, you know, you shouldn't have to say Black Lives Matter too. You shouldn't have to say that, you know, but that's what it means, is Black Lives Matter too. We've gone through all this bullshit in the United States, and motherfuckers are still getting strung up, shot in the back, you know, whatever is happening. And that if you believe that all lives matter, then you're on board with Black Lives Matter too.
Right. Yeah. It's, you know? And they don't realize it, man. It's such a crazy time. I mean, how has the quarantine time been for you? What have you been working on? Is it weird to be an artist, to be creative in this time? How's that experience been for you?
Yeah. When it was starting, the lockdown, I think I even tweeted something about it. Like, if you have all this free time, you ain't making any music, you stupid. I probably said something like that.
Yeah.
You
know?
And I really hadn't felt so creative during this time, because it turned out to be, you know, really fucking grim, like really grim. It's the death toll is one thing, but the unemployment on top of it, you know, the chaos caused by the White House, thinking about my own city, and I'm glad that we didn't have any major explosive situations. I think only one person got killed, and that was like somebody just shot in the crowd or something during a George Floyd protest. But in times like this, it's like trying to compose when you're hiding. Say for instance, if someone during the Holocaust was able to compose constantly by hiding from the Nazis, it just seems completely impossible that could be done. And in this situation, it was just really great. We're hiding out from this virus, and we're just getting all this bad news, and it's just all this bad news, and it's not something that, and it's not one type of bad news. Right. It's like so many types of bad news.
Ridiculous, man. Yeah, it's a perfect storm.
It's crazy. So right when you decide that you want to write something about COVID, then this George Floyd fucking thing happens, you know? Breonna Taylor, my man in Georgia,
Elijah McClain.
Oh my God. I mean, it's just like you can't even focus on one thing to be inspired by to make something as a result of it. It's just you have to kind of roll it up in the one whole big ball, and you know, that's, and then also, you know, you got just more information than any one person can handle being thrown at you constantly, whether it's on TV, you know, you watch TBS and there's commercials, you know, the show's on, it's 30 minutes, but the show's on for 10 minutes and there's 20 minutes of commercials or something. Just crazy like that. Or you're on social media and then there's, you know, alerts and blah, blah, blah. And then, yeah, you get an alert to your phone that there's a national, that there's a state emergency lockdown, and rah, 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 and it's just, it's just madness. It's really madness. It's crazy.
I agree, man. And I, you know, for you, I mean, just in general, say you're going into the studio, does writing music for you, does it start with an idea? Does it start with a concept? Does it start with you sitting down and experimenting and seeing where it goes? Like, what is your usual creative process look like?
Oh, it can start out with an idea, but the idea never forms into anything. And that I learned early on, which is, I might walk in with a bass line in my head, and then the minute I play it, it just doesn't sound like what I envisioned. It was, you know, gold in my head, but it was, you know, complete dog poo when I started playing it out, you know, sequenced, not sequenced, however it would go. But then that would kind of force me to move in another direction, and then I'll find something I like. So, you know, it could be a bass line that in my head is 8 bars, but how it ends up turning into a new idea might only be 2 beats, you know, or 4 beats, or a measure rather. It could be any situation like that. It could be from being a bass line to just changing the sound and playing some chords, and it's like, oh man, this sounds great, and then just start moving in that direction. When I couldn't afford a lot of equipment, I was beg, borrowing, and stealing everything that I could get where, however I could get it. You know, it was MMT-8 sequencer, HR-16 drum machine, a Prophet 600 synthesizer, and a 4-track tape deck. And you know, then I had from Derek gotten a sampler that only sampled 4 things at a time at a low sample rate. And I had to make that shit into something else. So I was making 6-9 tracks on there, you know, my machines, that 4-Jazz Funk Classics record, the Sound on Sound record, Light Music, all that stuff I was making with like really scaled down gear, and I was forced to do it. But as time went on and I was able to, you know, have more synthesizers and as a remixer and as a producer, the sound is something that's a big deal for me, and I'm my own engineer. So you know, it got into buying compressors and equalizers and different mix. I don't like this mixing console. I'll sell it and buy a new mixing console, and just, you know, blowing through all that stuff. But, you know, it's great. This is like me buying a garage full of Ferrari and you know, AMG Mercedes and Bentleys and all these things, you know, but I might have all these cars, but I can't drive them all, you know, cause I'll be on the road. And when I get home, I might just want to drive, you know, the little car, the Fiat 500 or something. I might want to just drive that around. And then the other stuff is sitting in the garage. And that's where it became with the studio, was that it just got to be so much of this processing gear that when I would start coming back to things, it's like, okay, well, what does this do? And I'll pull up an 808 rhythm. You know, this is a bullshit 808. Oh yeah, this does this. And I find myself sitting there with this 808 rhythm for days trying to figure out whether this EQ sounds a little better than another EQ does, or this compressor, what exactly does this one do in comparison? And you know, it's a very unhealthy way of you know, dealing with it, because there's nothing creative about it. So
yeah, well, what I'm hearing you talk about, right, is creative limitations and how important and helpful those can be. And I think that's a great lesson for anybody listening to this, because you can always, there's always that thought, especially if you're in a place where you're frustrated or you're not being creative in the way you want to be creative, that like there's something external that can fix it, right? Mm-hmm. And if you just find whatever that is,
I call it a silver bullet.
Yeah, perfect. That's exactly
what it is. Always looking for that silver bullet.
Yeah. You know? And it never comes. But if you're able to just restrict yourself and say, nope, this is what I have to work with.
Yeah.
For me, I don't know what it is. It mentally unlocks something else in your brain when you just know that you don't have that option anymore. You can't keep looking.
Right. Right. Yeah. And this was the beautiful thing about sampling, was that you were restricted to, say you had a MPC and turntable, you were restricted to the records that you had in your crib and how you used it with MPC. You know, you didn't have YouTube to sample from. You know, if you had the radio, you could sample something from the radio or put it on cassette. So it was the possibilities that could seem like they were endless, but they were still not infinite. They were very finite in what you could do. And it forced you to really work at it harder. And that's what I respect about, you know, all that early rap stuff is, you know, what they were able to do with MPC, or even in their situations, they were using SB 1200 and Akai 950, and a turntable and some records, and they were coming up with just some dynamite stuff, just amazing stuff.
I mean, they changed the world with it, man. It's crazy to think about.
For real, they did change the world. You are right.
Yeah, it's so nuts, man. And that's super inspirational too. I mean, this whole conversation, man, I'm really enjoying this, but I don't want to take up your whole day here.
We can definitely do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's so much more we could talk about, but maybe 5-10 minutes, just go through a couple things, like kind of a speed round where I just want to say a couple things. Maybe you just tell me, you know, what memories it brings up for you.
Sure.
Okay. One of those things, you mentioned it earlier, is Movement Festival. And that's something I know you've been involved with since the start. It's, you know, an internationally known and important festival at this point. But I think it's also a festival that's so integral to Detroit, and it's so localized at the same time. And, you know, for you, if we're just talking about Movement Festival, what are your memories of sort of the early days to where it is now?
Oh, when it was DMF, my objective was to do something similar to what the Electrifying Mojo did on the radio, but with techno music, with electronic music. So there was a lot of diversity in the acts that I hired. A lot of local guys, but I threw in some international guys as well. And the local international dynamic is still very strong with Movement Festival. It's not, you know, they're not trying to only do all local guys and you know, cut out the global impact that this music has had. And that's what's important, is to show that some guy in the UK was influenced by Detroit music, you know, because you get guys like Local Dice and Luciano and Carl Cox and Ricardo Villalobos and Sven Vaith and, you know, all these giants of techno music that come to Detroit, and they're just like, wow, you know, this is amazing. And they want to put their best foot forward because they're in Detroit. And I think that's important for people in Detroit and in America to see, to keep that respect factor.
I love that, man. Yeah, there's something about it. I've been a few times, and it really teaches people without really trying, you know? And I think not many festivals do that, where they actually, you know, I relate to where the space they're in, to the town they're in, to the music from there. I think that's something like Movement's been able to do better than almost any other festival, is to always remind people that, you know, this is here for a reason. The sounds are here for a reason. And yeah, man, I think it's an amazing thing you've been able to do with that.
Thank you. That's great.
All right. So I'm just bouncing around. One thing I wanted to talk about, this is random, but I just love it, is the Unity album that you made with Green Velvet.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
What, if I just say that, what comes to mind? What was that like working with him, putting that together?
Man, Curtis is always laughing. We're always throwing out jokes. I mean, ever since I've known him, he's been the same, you know, and it was fun. He brought his synthesizers to Detroit, and you know, we just kind of just rolled, and that was a lot of fun. I came to Chicago, and I mean, I love Curtis. He's amazing. I'm glad that we did it. Amazing time.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love him too, man. He's a fascinating guy.
Mm-hmm.
Another one I wanted to talk about, make sure we touched on it, was the Versus project that you did,
right.
Which, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, was your music taking some of your biggest tunes, translating them into an orchestral format, and actually not only just recording that, but taking that on the road. What was that like? Where did that idea come from? How did you feel about the execution of it? What'd you learn? What was that like?
Versus was an idea that came from my partner in the project, Alex Kazak. He's in Paris. His label's called Infine, which we released the record on. And Alex's wife is a professional violinist, I believe. So he always had this connection with symphonic music, and he's also the reason why I met Francesco Tristano was because he assigned Francesco to Infine, and he said, man, you know, it'll be great if we do a project that just fuses techno and symphonic music. And when I was in school, I used to play upright bass. I used to play concert bass along with other things I played. So I had interest in the music and a little experience in it. So fuck it. You know, I had interest in a little experience with jazz, and I did Detroit Experiment and these other projects, the Tribe. Rebirth album and whatever. So for doing Versus, it was a natural thing. I love music. I love pushing my boundaries, and it just made sense to do it.
Mm. What was the reaction like on some of those first performances? Did people know what to make of it?
In Paris, man, they were going for it. They were eating it up. And, what we did in Paris, we did the pieces as collaboration with Francesco. We did a version of Recomposed with Moritz von Oswald. And then the orchestra also did a couple of Steve Reich pieces. And I think that was it. So it was a good 90 minutes of music that was done. And, you know, it was incredible. Like the people went for it. It was unbelievable. The response, at the end when we did, I can't remember the title that we did at the end, but it just blew the roof off, you know. And other people had done something similar. Jeff Mills, he did his performance with the Montpellier Orchestra. But I think that our fusion of electronic music and orchestral music came together better than anyone had done it before that I had seen because of the scores. And the scores were done by Francesco. So Francesco is a techno enthusiast, and he understands, you know, the idea of repetitive music and repetitive loops. And I think that that is important for anyone in the future that's doing this collaboration, is that you have to have somebody who understands both sides, not somebody that says, oh yeah, I know techno music. I heard that, I can do that, you know, because right. People do that all the time. They'll sell you on something, but it's not really doing it. But Francesco, young, eager, excited. And it didn't hurt that he went to Juilliard too. So
I don't think that ever hurts. Yeah.
Oh no, that didn't hurt at all.
Well, man, this has been great. Just to wrap it up, you know, you wear so many different hats, right? The DJ, producer, musician, record label owner, event promoter. You know, you did a sound installation at an art museum. How do you see yourself in 2020, and what keeps you going? What's the most exciting? What's the most fun? You know, what do you really get gassed up about in 2020 and looking out into the future?
I mean, as of right now, there's not one thing in particular that's really, really blowing me away. I hate to say this, and I'd said this in the bank yesterday to the woman. I said, man, this was the best summer that I've had in a long time. Mm. And she's like, you're probably the only person that's ever said that. But the reason why it was for me was because I had a lot of time with my family, a lot of time with myself.
Yeah.
A lot of time to do things that I really needed to, like sleep, you know, because usually by this time in the year, you know, every weekend I'm playing 4 to 5 dates in different cities, different countries and whatever. So there was just this train that was going constantly. And, you know, unfortunately somebody pulled
the brake, yeah.
The brake, yeah, and it stopped everything. But, you know, I had more time with my kids, more time with my wife. We rented a van and drove from Barcelona to Switzerland, to Verbier, Switzerland.
Oh, that sounds
amazing.
And then
Prague, and then drove back through France, and then back to Barcelona. And it was really something that I don't think we would have been able to do if I was still doing gigs in the same way that I've been doing for the last, you know, that capacity of gigs was probably for 15 years.
Yeah.
That I was doing it like that.
It takes a toll, man. It builds up.
Yeah.
And do you think, you know, just off of that, do you think when things get back to normal, whenever that's going to be, do you think you'll take anything from this time, approach your career differently, approach road life, the balance of all that?
Probably not.
Yeah. Well, you got a break then.
Yeah, I got a break. I'll probably jump right back on that train and, you know, going at high speed, Trans Europe Express.
That's a beautiful thing to look forward to, too.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking the time to do this, man. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, me too. That was a good combo.
Thanks, bro. All right. right, that's the show. Shout out to Carl Craig. Great to have you on, man. For everybody out there listening, I hope you enjoyed that as much as I did. Don't forget, if you're anywhere near upstate New York, party after party, the Sonic installation, the art exhibition from Carl Craig, is open right now at the Dia Beacon Gallery. He's got new music out with Dubfire. There's a new DJ mix from 2019. And you can hit the link in the description of this episode to go keep up with everything that Carl Craig is doing. My name is Willie Joy. You can keep up with me as well at Willie Joy or at Back to Back Pod on all social media, or you can hit me up directly. backtobackpod@gmail.com is the email address. Give us a shout out on social media, put up a tweet, tag us in your stories, let people know they should be tuning in to Back to Back. That is the best way to support this show. It is also the best way to connect with me. I'm always going to be interacting with anything you put out there. I love to meet you guys. And to build on that connection, I would also love to have you come join the Back to Back Discord server. The link for that is also in the description of this episode. So join the Discord, come chat with me, come hang out with the awesome Back to Back community. That just about does it for this week. I hope everybody out there is staying safe. I hope you're staying healthy, staying happy, staying productive if you're trying to be productive, or, you know, staying lazy if you're trying to be lazy, because, you know, we all got to do that sometimes too. Shout out to all the lazy people out there. Shout out to, you know, all the aspiring lazy people who have a hard time letting themselves be lazy. I feel you on that one. But whatever gear you're in this week, man, lean into it. Go hard on it. Whatever you're doing, have some fun. Take care of yourself. Take care of the people around you. And I will talk to you next week. For Back to Back, this is Willie Joy. Peace.